Hello, and welcome to Episode 8 of the Rocky Mountain Mason Podcast. I am Ben Williams, your host, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine, and today I thought I'd read to you an article first published in Issue 7 of the Rocky Mountain Mason and also the Knight Templar magazine back in 2015, titled Lies of Larminius. Why the Larminius Charter, reporting a secret succession of Grand Masters since Jacques de Molay, is most likely a fake. The sun was like a wound above the road to Versailles, spilling blood into the clouds. The men were feverish. Führer demands a quickening, it seems, even as gravity sweeps the blade. They burst into the jails all at once and hacked the noblemen to bits. It was September 9th, 1792. Justice is too slow, it seems. Something had to be done. No. Something had to be undone. Among the prisoners that day was Louis Hercule Timoleon, Duc de Cossé-Brissac, a regular at the king's court, master of the king's pantry, and governor of Paris. He had broken bread with kings. Now he was just another dismembered corpse, reduced to anonymity in death and the equality of bones. Several days later, maybe weeks, the crowd became impatient as the lots were cried. A man stepped forward and raised his hand. It was brother Jacques-Philippe Ledru, physician to House of Brissac, the son of Nicolas-Philippe Ledru, the famous prestidigitator, illusionist and man about town, known by his cognomen Comus for the Greek god of revelry, who'd once performed for the king. But brother Jacques was less famous than his father. No one had recognized him. He bid again. He must win that desk. So begins the legend of Larminius. Freemasonry is filled with stories of lost knowledge found in some hollow place. The antediluvian wisdom of Atlantis had survived the flood in a hollow pillar, a replica Ark of the Covenant beneath the Holy of Holies, so why not the temple in the leg of an escritoire? Did Jacques Ledru, physician to Cossé-Brissac, know a parchment was concealed in the leg of the desk he won that day at auction? Or was he just trying to salvage his patron's estate? We may never know. But it wasn't until 12 years later that any discovery was announced, this time by another physician, Brother Bernard Raymond Fabre Palaprat, at the court of Napoleon. Fabre Palaprat and Ledru were brothers and friends. Ledru had apparently shown the partro to Fabre Palaprat and a few others. It was written in a simple substitution cipher, but once deciphered, it appeared to read in Latin an unbroken chain of grand masters of the Poor Knights of Christ and the Temple of Solomon, irrefutable proof of the succession, you see, from the death of Jacques de Molay in 1314 right up to 1792, with the bloody execution of the last grand master in secret, Cossé-Brissac himself, heaped up in that Versailles prison. It was just too good to be true. By authority of the charter in their possession, Fabre Palaprat and Ledru sought to resurrect a new Templar lineage. But Ledru refused the Grand Mastership. Perhaps he thought it unseemly. It was deemed by all that some noble should take the title. Fabre Palaprat graciously deigned to fill the office, at least temporarily, until a suitable replacement of noble blood could be found. But he had no desire to relinquish the position. He retained the Grand Mastership for the rest of his life. He kept many titles, each betraying some sort of desire for aggrandizement, such as Most Eminent Highness and Very Great, Powerful, and Excellent Prince, even Most Serene Lord. Apparently, the humility of the temple, which typically dubbed its leaders Vicars of Christ, had escaped Mr. Fabre Palaprat. Such large personalities as these, though, would result in splits to his newfound order, and rend the establishment of a Gnostic church based on yet another discovery he claimed to have made, of a long-lost Gospel of John, known as the Leviticon. This apocryphal text essentially rewrote the Gospel according to John, placing John in supereminency over Christ. But the Johannite Gnostic Church, as it became known, would likewise splinter, as so many do, among the avaricious indealings of zealous disciples and overcompensating egos. Today, a number of neo-Templar organizations feign legitimacy to the Temple through this document and this man. They poo-poo the Masonic Knights Templar as some sort of imposition on their rightful ascendancy. They seem to need proof of a direct lineage to the last Grand Master of the Temple, and neglect what makes a man a knight in the first place. Not a parchment, but his heart. Most scholars believe the parchment, the Larminius Charter as it has come to be known, to be a forgery, either by Philippe, Duke of Orleans, with the assistance of a Jesuit monk known only as Bernani in the early 18th century, probably around 1705, or by Ludru and Palaprat themselves in the early 19th century, around 1804. Zealots of neo-Templar organizations, on the other hand, are steadfast. The document is real, they declaim, and any attempts to denounce it as a forgery are proof enough of a conspiracy of Mother Church to discredit their rightful place. Unfortunately, there is motivation on both sides of this issue. For those who wish to legitimize their orders, or cults as case may be, and those who wish to delegitimize them, there is a certain madness, unfortunately, that seems to attach to the Knights Templar, and twist their legend to substantiate some sort of personal delusion. This makes men artful, even deceitful, and motivates each side as claimants of veracity. I've had personal experience of this madness, I'm afraid. I've met one such knight, a Grand Master of one particular Neo-Templar organization, as it happens, who claimed, by inheritance of the true Templar secrets, no doubt, to be able to turn lead into gold. In attempts to prove his magical ability, though, he was discovered in his ruse. He had simply concealed a jeweler's strip of gold to the bottom of the crucible, in the hopes it would melt during the experiment, and then be revealed as an amorphous blob once the chaff had burned away. Unfortunately for him, he failed to heat it enough, and the obviousness of his fraud was embarrassing to us both. When the flame was turned off and the ash removed, a perfect strip of jeweler's gold was revealed. You could still make out the marks left by the tin snips used to cut it down to size. "That's odd," he said. "This time it manifested as a strip of gold stuck to the bottom of the crucible." Something changed before my eyes that day, I assure you. But it wasn't the gold. Some men grow delusions like rose gardens. If you expose them for what they are, weeds choking out the truth, they attack you as if defending their life's work. Sadly, in many cases, it actually is. This unhappy fact is pertinent to the exchanges we find throughout history regarding the Larminius Charter, alas, from both sides. So bear that in mind. The Larminius Charter, then, has been written about extensively, not least by the eminent Masonic scholar Albert Mackey in his Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. Mackey takes an unfavorable view of the document, drawing off the research performed in the latter 19th century by a number of writers who claim to have examined it in person. And I quote, "He, the Duke of Orleans, caused new statutes to be constructed, and an Italian Jesuit, by the name Father Bernani, who was a learned antiquary and an excellent designer, fabricated the document, now known as the Charter of Larminius, and thus pretended to attach the new society to the ancient order of Templars." According to Mackey, Philippe, Duke of Orleans, had established a rakish society at the French court, known as Le Petit Resurrection des Templiers. It dealt in lechery, overeating, and general largesse. Its mark was a man's foot on a woman's face. Whatever the exploit of this society of the French royal court, once discovered, King Louis XIV found it necessary to disband it. We read in Mackey, "In the year 1682, and in the reign of Louis XIV, a licentious society was established by several young noblemen, which took the name of La Petite Resurrection des Templiers, or the Little Resurrection of the Templars. The members wore concealed upon their shirts a decoration in the form of a cross, on which was embossed the figure of a man trampling on a woman, who lay prostrate at his feet. The emblematic signification of this symbol was, it is apparent, as unworthy of the character of man as it was derogatory to the condition and claims of woman. And the king, having been informed of the infamous proceedings which took place at the meetings, dissolved the society, which, it was said, was on the eve of initiating the Dauphin, caused its leader, a prince of the blood, to be ignominiously punished, and banished the members from the court, the heaviest penalty that, in those days of servile submission to the throne, could be inflicted on a courtier. Then, Mackey suggests, Ledru, who may have garnered the charter from the hollow leg of Cosse de Ressac's writing desk, or assisted in the fabrication of it outright, and Fabre Palaprat, used the document to establish their own Templar authority, this time with political aspirations. Even Napoleon, it is said, drew some interest in the group. According to Mackey, one Francisco Alvaro da Silva Frevre de Porto infiltrated the order shortly after its founding. Da Silva was, it is alleged, an agent of King John V of Portugal, whose Knights of Christ legitimately claimed ascendancy from the temple. Da Silva became Fabre Palaprat's secretary in the order, and, at Fabre Palaprat's direction, sent a copy of the charter to King John V of Portugal, seeking authentication and legitimacy for the order. But the king denounced it as fake. Nonetheless, this document of much controversy remains important for a number of reasons. If real, it demonstrates that de Molay had conferred the order of the temple to a successor, to be perpetuated in secret, and I quote, only to be made known after due profession and knightly consecrations, end quote, had occurred. If a forgery, then the attempt to impose it on the world is a bold and unworthy deception, and, as any equilibrium must depend on its initial conditions, so those orders claiming their legitimacy from it are likewise deceived, and thus ultimately deceitful. Neo-Templar organizations claiming their descendancy through the charter are Ordo Supremus Militaris Templi Hierosoli Militani, the OSMTH, forgive my pronunciation, and Ordre Sovereign de Militaire du Temple de Jérusalem, the OSMTJ, and offshoots of these organizations, which include the Johannite Gnostic Church and the Ordre Sovereign du Temple Initiatique, or OSTI, founded by Amorque Imperator Raymond Bernard, after his initiation into OSMTH in the 1950s. Of course, each claims to be the one true temple. Most scholars contend the charter's Latin, once substituted for the simple cipher in which the document was originally written, is too good, the scholastic, ecclesiastical Latin more typical of the 18th century than the 14th century. Worshipful brother Christopher Hodap takes this view, writing in The Templar Code for Dummies that the charter, which is actually in the hands of the Freemasons and is available for inspection at Mark Mason's Hall in London, is indeed written in a cipher code, and when translated, is in Latin, as one would expect document from the 14th century Catholic order of monks to be. But it is not in the ecclesiastical form of Latin typically found in religious documents of the period. Instead, it is polished, formal, and quite scholarly, a little too scholarly, in fact. However, this argument is not, by itself, convincing. Latin is an old language, and certainly the Church has cultivated perfection in Latin during the centuries it has employed the language, since even the Dark Ages. This view was confirmed to me personally by the chair of the Department of Languages and Literature at Denver University, Dr. Victor Castellani. However, Dr. Castellani did point out some specific discrepancies in the usage more typical of a later time, particularly the use of the word rerum, originally translated as thing, and used in the charter ecclesiastically to mean the world. In his own words, maybe it's too classical according to people who know this style, but that doesn't bother me at all. It's a nice usage, but it could be anachronistic. It could be something that was not done at the time when this was supposed to be written, and something that was picked up during the humanist period. If the forger is a Jesuit, he has the benefit of Catholic humanism. The Latin of someone like Erasmus, for example, is much better than the Latin of Dante. He also pointed out the single lettering in words like quator and commissar, spelling them with one T and one S, respectively, ordinarily using a double consonant. Not definitive proof of a forgery, mind you, but a suggestion that the author was possibly Spanish, as the suspected forger, Benani, was meant to be. And I should interject here that when I gave this transcription, the Latin, which I typed up on a Word document and gave it to Dr. Castellani, he did not know anything about it, where it came from, and he is not familiar with its history. So the fact that he said Jesuit and the fact that he said Spanish, I thought was very telling. Another question is the specific phraseology employed in the second paragraph, ad majoram dei gloriam, meaning to the greater glory of God, the motto of the Jesuit order itself, established in 1540, more than 200 years after the year when John Marcus Laminius was meant to be penning the document. Granted, it could be a coincidence, but it is a significant one. Supporters of the document may contend, however, that this was because the founder of the Jesuits, Ignatius de Loyola, was influenced by the secret Templars. The Society of Jesus was, after all, founded in Paris. But it does seem more likely a forger, if a Jesuit, as alleged, could not resist putting in a nod to his own order. Further clues are found in the method and style of illumination of the manuscript. At the turn of the 20th century, the document fell to the scrutiny of the premier research lodge of England, Quattro Coronati. We read from a paper regarding that inquiry, "The charter has been carefully examined for me by Sir George Warner, keeper of the manuscripts in the British Museum, who is one of the greatest experts on the subject. He says that whilst the Latin is that of the 14th century, the illumination cannot be, but it may be any time from the latter part of the 15th century, so that we seem no nearer to the true history of this remarkable document than before." But for me, the clincher is towards the end in the charter proper, where Laminius himself calls down a curse upon the Scottish Templars, denouncing them, and I quote, "beyond the pale of the temple," end quote. Quoting the document, "Finally, on consequence of a decree of a supreme convention of the brethren, and by the supreme authority to me committed, I will declare and command that the Scottish Templars, as deserters of the order, are to be accursed, and that they and the brethren of St. John of Jerusalem, upon whom may God have mercy, as spoliators of the domains of our soldiery, are now and hereafter to be considered as beyond the pale of the temple. I have therefore established signs, unknown to our false brethren, and not to be known by them, to be orally communicated to our fellow soldiers, and in which way I have already been pleased to communicate them in the Supreme Convention." This seems to be a dig at the Scotch Templars of Masonic origin. It is certainly odd that a Grand Master of the Templars would curse any knights that escaped the flames of the perfidious Pope and the corrupt King of France. You would think he would be happy for them. And Scotland was not the only place deserting knights fled either. Particularly, Portugal was a safe haven. There, the Templars simply changed their names to the Knights of Christ. There were substantially more fleeing Templars in Portugal than Scotland, especially around the time period when this charter is supposed to have been written. And some knights surely made it to Switzerland too. Thus, this curse by a supposed Grand Master just feels out of place, out of time, partial, exacted, and peculiar, unless we accept that the real author of the charter was deliberately attempting to bolster his Templar organization above a competitor organization, such as the Masonic Knights Templar, well established at the time of writing, say, in the late 18th century, when the Scottish connection to the Knights Templar was gaining reputation, following Ramsay's famous oration in 1741. And anyway, how would Laminius have known the Templars had deserted to Scotland if it was not, indeed, part of some plan to escape Philip the Fair's mass arrest? In order for him to denounce them, he must have been aware of their flight there. The inherent logic just doesn't hold up. It seems much more likely that this curse was motivated to bolster a competitor above a rival and diminish an established history of the temple, which, in fact, was not established until the latter 18th century, nearly 500 years after the time of the charter. Additional points raised by people who have examined the charter include an illiterate man's signature as Grand Master, showing some good penmanship for an illiterate, and incorrect titling of various nobles throughout the list. But vexingly, These are still explainable in other ways, aside from forging the document. However, with each addition of another curiosity and peculiarity, the odds begin to build until it becomes statistically unlikely the document is genuine. Why would all the Grand Masters of the Temple be nobles at the French royal court? While this is possible, it does seem a little imprudent for a secret order committed to acts of charity in secret, and perhaps contrary any belief in humility and sacred anonymity. Moreover, anyone who requires such a document to prove that they are direct descendants of the Temple is suspect, and their motivations surely questionable. Legitimacy doesn't come from veracious claims to some transmission. It comes from receipt of teachings and their adoption in the heart. The true inheritor wears the mantle of simple truth, never grandiose claims desirous of legitimacy. Perhaps the only way to be sure, though, is to carbon date the document. On this note, I emailed the Mark Mason's Grand Lodge on St. James Street in London earlier this year, this is back in 2014, offering to pay for such a test. After a few weeks, I received a rather short reply. "We do not wish to carbon date the Larminius Charter," it said. "Like so many things in our craft, brethren, perhaps the mystery is better than fact." Relics of de Molay, supposedly in possession of a neo-Templar organization founded by Bernard Raymond Fabre Palaprat in 1805. 1. A charter of Larminius. 2. A volume of 27 paper sheets in folio, bound in crimson, velvet, satin, and gold, containing the statutes of the order in manuscript, and signed Philippe, the Duke of Orleans. 3. A small copper reliquary in the shape of a Gothic cathedral, containing 4 fragments or burnt bones wrapped in a piece of linen, said to be taken from the funeral pyre at Isles de Jeufs, i.e. as belonging either to Jacques de Molay or Geoffrey de Charnay. 4. A sword said to have belonged to de Molay. 5. A helmet supposed to be of Guy, the Dauphin d'Auvergne. 6. An old gilt spur. 7. A bronze patina, in the interior of which is engraved an extended hand, having the ring and little fingers bent in upon the palm, which is in the form of the episcopal benediction in the Roman Church. 8. A pax in gilt bronze, containing a representation of St. John under a Gothic arch. The pax is a small plate of gold, silver, or other rich material, carried round by the priest to communicate the kiss of peace. 9. 3 Gothic seals. 10. A tall ivory cross and 3 mitres, richly ornamented. 11. The Beaucion, in white linen with 4 black rays. And 12. The war standard in white linen with 4 black rays. So some of the intriguing parts of the charter I would like to point out. So the charter is basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 7 paragraphs of Latin. And it begins with Ego frater Johann Marcus Larminius, Hiero Solimitianus, Deo gratia, le secretissimo. Don't worry, I'm not going to read the whole thing in Latin, and on it goes. But then it says this, like in the second paragraph, in the second line, we read, Notum sit omnibus tam praesentibus quam futuris quod deficit deficitibus propter extramum verta viribus rerum augustia et gubernacali gravitate perpensis ad majorum dei gloriam ordenis fratum et staturatum blah 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 blah. And that ad majorem dia gloriam is to the greater glory of God, which was the motto of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, founded in 1540, 226 years after the death of Jacques de Molay. Then we have 2 instances of the use of a single letter, when usually there would be 2, unless the author was Spanish. And of course, Larminius, Johannes Larminius, was supposed to be of sort of Germanic, I believe, origin. Nonetheless, so quator should be Q-U-A-T-T-U-O-R, and here it only has 1 T. And then in the following paragraph, we have, e suprima mihi commissa auctoritate. And the commissa should be commissa, but it only has one. And then we have this very odd curse of the Scottish Templars, which does seem a bit odd that the Grand Master of the Templars would curse the men who escaped to Scotland, especially since most of them actually escaped to Portugal. Unless the writer of the Latin was seeking to delegitimize competitors using Scottish dependency for their own legitimacy. So here we are in the midst of some sort of Masonic rivalry. So I thank you very much for your time. And if you enjoyed this podcast and are interested in more material of this nature, please do subscribe to our magazine. It is available for subscription at www.rockymountainmason.com. And actually, this issue of the magazine is available on our Read Online link. You can have access to 9 online issues, the very first 9, this being, I believe, issue number 7. Also, please visit www.laughinglion.net, our parent company's website, for small batch, high quality items you may find of interest. As well as other literature that Laughing Lion has prepared for various Grand Lodge jurisdictions. Until next time, take care and Godspeed.